Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council and your moderator for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. As an aside, when I first came to establish a relationship with the Commonwealth Club, it was when the executive director of the Center for Islamic Studies, Munir Jiwa, was speaking here, and the council was asked to moderate. And I said, we'll do it on the condition that our 87-year-old Jewish executive director, Rita Simmel, could moderate. And she got up here and she said, what's a nice Jewish girl like me doing in a place like this? In terms of our presence here today, I'd like to say, because of the theme, Turkey and Armenia, what's a nice Greek fellow like me doing in a place like this? It's my very distinct pleasure to introduce our wonderful speaker, Dr. Stephen West. Dr. West holds a PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Cultures from UCLA and a BA in Government from Oberlin College. He was a Fulbright scholar to Turkey and taught Turkish language and cultural history at UCLA and at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. West has lived in Turkey, Cyprus, Lebanon, and Austria. Presently, he teaches cross-cultural communication and courses on linguistics and the Middle East. I've had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with Dr. West today, and I think that you're in for a real treat. And without further ado, we hand the podium over to Dr. West.
Good afternoon. Thank you for making the effort to come today. I don't know if it's raining right now, but it's supposed to be a little bit of rain, and I appreciate your persistence and your interest in this material. I would like to spend the next 35 or 40 minutes with you talking about something that is very close to my heart and has been for a long time. I first want to tell you that I'm not Turkish, nor am I an Armenian, nor am I a Greek. I am from Indiana. So what does that mean? Well, it means that I have a European heritage, mostly German, probably about 80% in my bloodlines and my cultural background. So I'm a so-called white man of this country, and I'll talk about that a little bit later as it relates to some of the things that we'll discuss. I'm a map freak, so I will have you, if you might just join me with a few maps to look at this issue of Turkey and Armenia and what may be going on. I would appreciate that. The first thing that I'd like to have you pay attention to is on the page that I think you all have now. And I'd like to look at the very first statement that you see there. This is Gert Hofstede, who is a well-known cross-cultural specialist from the Netherlands. And I just want to read this to you, and I'd like to just have it sort of permeate your thinking, if you might, for our hour together today. The survival of mankind will depend to a large extent on the ability of people who think differently to act together. That may sound like a really wonderful, rosy bit of information. It's absolutely crucial, and it goes very deep. And I think it's an exciting time to be alive, because I think we are learning how to do this, all of us around the world. And Turkey and Armenia are learning how to do this as we speak. It's very exciting because my first involvement in the Middle East goes back actually a long time ago. I will quickly mention to you, my father was the founder of Heifer International, and some of you may know what that is, but I'm going to bring it in a little bit later, especially with Azerbaijan and Armenia, because it's directly relevant to this process we're referring to here. And you see the three principles on this single page. I'd like to have you, if you will, sort of have these thoughts permeate your own thinking as we go through this material today. If we can do this, if we can do these three around the world, we'll make it. We will survive. We will not only survive 500 years from now, we may very well thrive. And I'm optimistic enough to choose to believe that we can do this. And I also want to put a little disclaimer here to tell you that I am not going to make a judgment about Turks or Armenians today. I can't do that because I'm not a Turk and I'm not an Armenian. If I am involved in cultural change, it's going to be my own. That's the only one I can work on, which is the essentially the WASP culture, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture of our country. That one I can work on because I'm a member of it. I do not have the mandate or the authority to make a judgment toward Turks or Armenians. I cannot do that. If I try, then I will always miss something that is at the heart and soul of Turkish or Armenian culture. So I will leave that alone. This is a fiery issue, as you know, and I would like us to, in a sense, go toward the fire, but let's not burn any houses down. Mahatma Gandhi said it well. He said, in terms of the multicultural understanding, he said, I have my house, and you can bring in the Muslim air, you can bring in the Buddhist air, the Hindu air, the Christian air through the window, but don't blow my house down. Very important. So that's the potential that I think that we have in this work. Number one, becoming truly aware of our own cultural heritage, taking responsibility for what we have done in the past, including the brutality. I don't think there's any representative of any culture in this room who doesn't have some kind of brutality somewhere in our history. Euro-Americans of this country certainly are guilty of that as well. We don't have to go very far in history to see that. Take responsibility for that brutality. Become conscious of what we ourselves bring to every cross-cultural interaction. Just here today, I can feel this already. There's a culture here. There are lots of you have come, and I really appreciate that. You also bring, there's an atmosphere. There's a cultural set of values. I'm not sure that we could write them down very quickly, but think about that for a second. You've come here for some reason. You've come here because you care, I should guess. You care a lot about this material. You care about this earth. You care about your own country. You care about your children, your grandchildren. And so that's the cultural baggage that every one of us walking into this room, we carry that with us. Number two, acknowledging and validating the humanity that is present in all cultures. And I would say, so what is it that, here's just translating this again, I remember as an outsider, even though I know quite a bit about Turkey, especially, I still am an outsider. And I would say, what is at the heart of Armenian culture that Turks can no longer afford to ignore? What is that stuff? What is the humanity that Armenians will carry with them as all human beings do? What's at the heart of Turkish culture that Armenians can no longer afford to ignore? And then the last one, enacting new skills of cross-cultural interaction. Stop the mudslinging. It's so easy to sling mud in someone else's face. And stop it. We can just stop it. And say, all right, you have a life story. I will sit here and listen to your life story. What is that? And I will try my best to hold back in my judgment. If we can do these three things, we'll make it. So I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'd like to have you join me for a little bit of history here. And I've given out, Celia may have mentioned to you, for those of you who are interested, I put together a historical sketch of Turks and Armenians going back to the earliest history. I'll just touch on a few of those today. But if anyone is interested in copies, you can talk with Celia about that if you'd like. So let's take a look here at where do these folks come from? The Armenians and the Turks, who are they? When you say someone is Armenian or someone is Turkish, what are we talking about? And if we can easily take an argument that, well, the Armenians were here first in this area, so it's theirs. The land is theirs. The Turks are latecomers. They've only been there about 1,000 years in the Middle East, a little over. But let's just quickly trace that slightly. If we say, I'll start with the Indo-Europeans. Armenian, by the way, is directly related to English, as is Greek, as are most of the languages of India. There's something there. It's not only linguistic, but it's also there's also cultural material involved in that. It's no mistake that Greeks and Armenians are Christians. That's not an accident. That's part of their heritage. So where do these Indo-European folks come from? Basically, here I'll just put this as the Indo-European people. Can you see that all right? A little bit? If I back away. if it's not focused, please do tell me. So I'll focus only on the Armenians. The traditional view is that Armenians would have come this way through Thrace and into Turkey was called Anatolia. It was never called Turkey until relatively recent times. So the Armenians would have come here, the traditional view, and they ended up in this area that you see here is called Armenia today. That's one theory. There are others who say, well, they probably came this way. It's perhaps a shorter distance to replace the Urartu culture that was there. We're going back 3,000 years now, more than 3,000 years. That's when essentially all of the Indo-European people came to Turkey, what we call Turkey, the Greeks, the Armenians, the Hittites, the Luvians. It's a long list of people who spoke languages directly related to English. All right, so let me go ahead with just a few thoughts that relate there. going back, so BCE, you'll see this those of you who get a copy of the sketch. Before BCE, before the Common Era, so before 2,000 years ago, essentially, Armenia was divided into two parts. What's Greater Armenia and what's called Lesser Armenia. And I'll quickly show you what I mean by that with this map here. This is, you can see here, let's get this straight. Okay, here's Armenia. Can everybody see this behind me? Probably not. Okay, I'll go back and forth and hopefully you can see. This is now Armenia today. But there was also what was called Lesser Armenia, was in the area of Adana, the Cilician Gates, which is now part of Turkey. This, for three or four times throughout Armenian history, there have been two Armenias. This has been the Lesser Armenia, and this was the Greater Armenia. So keep that in mind, just as a backdrop to this whole thing. All right. The Armenians were some of the first major culture to become Christians. This is at the end of the 3rd century. That's a source of tremendous pride for the Armenian people. The Armenian writing system was developed around 400. 400 of the Common Era. Okay. Now, let's talk about the Turks. Where do the Turks come from? What does it mean when you say someone is a Turk? Or what does it mean when you say someone is an Armenian, for that matter? What that means is there are two things that really set aside a people. It's their language and their religion. If you talk about someone, say, well, who are you? You're an Arab. Well, what does that mean? That means that your mother tongue is Arabic. And you may be a Muslim, you may be a Christian. If you are a Kurd, what does that mean? Well, that means your mother tongue is Kurdish. Also, by the way, directly related to English. and you probably are a Sunni Muslim. If you say you're an American, what does that mean? It's very hard. I find it, I'm less and less able to define what that means now, and that's probably a good thing. But one thing we can say, very likely, is that we speak English. You know, I'm a man, I speak English, I have German heritage. That's probably enough. You can leave it alone after that. I come from a Christian heritage. That's going to tell you a lot of information about who I am. Let's take a look at the Turks then, in the broader sense. This is, and it's relatively recent information, that the Turks, linguistically, are directly related to the Japanese, the Koreans, and the Mongols. That is fairly new information. 30 or 40 years ago, they were considered independent. Japanese and Korean were considered independent. I have taught Turkish. I know it fairly well, and I've studied some Japanese. It's amazing how close they are. Not in terms of sound, of course not. They're separated by thousands of years. But the grammar that ties them together is amazingly close. So here is where these folks came from. I'll use the red for the Altaic people. These are the Indo-Europeans, and these are the Altaic people. If you can read that, I hope that's not bleeding out here. The Turks went this way, and then they also came down into the Middle East, specifically first to Iraq. The Mongols stayed here. Let me just finish this so I don't jerk you around with this. Koreans went here, and the Japanese went here. By the way, the Japanese walked to Japan. They didn't take any boats. They didn't need to, because the land was, the sea level was so low that they simply walked there. So here are the Turks coming in now, relatively recently. 815 is actually the year when Turks were brought in to Baghdad as bodyguards, as slaves, bodyguards for the Arab Muslim caliphs. And before long, I'm going to jump ahead because I can tell I'm going to run out of time otherwise. This is 1055, brings the Turks to Iraq. And then very quickly, they begin to move in this direction and then into Turkey. Between the 11th and the 14th centuries, that is the time when the people of Turkey, people of Anatolia, I should say, became Turks, the vast majority. If you had a heritage from some other language or religion, you became a Muslim, and your name might become Ahmet or Mehmet, and you are now a Turk. That is not a racial term, not at all. It's a cultural term. It has to do with your language and your religion. And so that's... let me jump ahead because I can tell that I'm going to do it. Otherwise, I won't make it through the time. The Ottoman Turks were a remarkable empire that built up in. If any of you have been to Turkey, you know the area southeast of Istanbul called Bursa. That's where the Principality of the Ottomans began. And what's remarkable about the as an empire is that there were 10 sultans in a row. Each one complementing the one in the path that just before him. The first one to conquer new territory, the second one to consolidate. Up to the point of the 10th Sultan, who was Suleiman the Magnificent. Many of you may have heard of him. He was probably the best known Ottoman Sultan. And it was under his leadership that Vienna was almost taken by the Turks. This is a source of a lot of history and pain, and I'm going to skirt over the top of all of that, and I'm going to ask you to put your seatbelts on in this regard, as I'm going to try to myself. It's so important for us to talk about this material and not burn the house down. Go toward the volcano, feel a little bit of heat, but let's try to lighten up a little bit so that we can actually talk about these things. Then the next event that I'd like to share with you is the end of the Middle Ages. Some of you may remember this date. 1453 was when the Ottoman Turks took Constantinople, which is there's a part of me that's just as Greek as Turkish. I lived in Cyprus, as I mentioned to you. So Constantinople became Istanbul, which is Istanbul. That's literally where the phrase comes from. Comes from Greek. If you haven't been to Constantinople, if you like, or Istanbul, please go. It's a fabulous city with 3,000 years of history that just go right through your whole system. You can't avoid it if you just spend some time there. And it's not just Turkish. Remember that. It's a very international place. Very quickly, what I'd like to mention to you also is that the Turks at the time of the Ottoman Empire actually enacted a principle from the Quran, which many of you may be aware of, and that is taking decent care of the people of the book. Muhammad made it very clear in the Quran, Jews and Christians are the people of the book. And the Turks actually did a pretty good job of this. As you know, in Spain, things got really awful with the Spanish Inquisition. Where did many of them go? Where did many of the Jewish people go? They went to Istanbul. Where did many Greeks and Armenians find their calling as ministers and translators and people of business and education? It was from the Armenians or in the Turks and the Jews and the Greeks who were in Istanbul. The Turks actually did a fairly good job of that. Now I'm going to jump right away to the modern period, and we'll go into the painful part of what this is about. Between 1897, the Armenian Revolutionary Movement began to develop in response to a growing national sentiment. And here, what I'd like to just mention to you is that. Remember something. It's not that long ago that the population of the earth was relatively small. We just in our lifetimes, you know we're pushing, well, we're 7 billion now on earth. It was in the millions not only several centuries ago. So as population grew and as national boundaries began to be developed, you see it here. If you look at these boundaries, where did they come from? You have Turkey, you have Armenia, Georgia, Russia, Bulgaria. Here's Greece. Who put those boundaries there? That's quite recent. That is not the way the empires of the past governed. They governed from without boundaries. There were no lines on a map. But all of a sudden, starting in the 1800s, and then it came to a painful head at the end of the 1800s, right when my own father was born in 1893, and this was right at that time that it became a huge issue. Back up a little bit more. The Ottoman Empire, as you know, was called the sick man of Europe for centuries. The French, the British, or the Russians could have carved it up easily in just a few weeks if they had chosen to. But it was competition with each other that kept this sick man of Europe alive for a long time. That's not a value judgment. I don't want anyone to be offended by that phrase. But at the end of World War I, that's when it became really clear that we need our piece of land, whoever we are. We Turks need our land. We Armenians, we need our piece of land for our home. And so that's where this part of Turkey in the First World War became a really painful. Look, these were massacres. I don't think there's any way to talk about it. Both sides massacred. The Turks and the Armenians both are guilty of massacre at this time. And it's on the issue of where are we going to have our home. I'll just mention this to you as well. I would say that the first massacre of Armenians by Turks took place in 1896 after Armenians seized the Ottoman Bank in Istanbul. Thousands were killed. In 1909, more Armenian demonstrations provoked the second massacre of Armenians by Turks in Adana in southern Turkey. And then we go to 1915, probably the most painful year between Turks and Armenians. It started out with an Armenian massacre of local Muslims in the area of Van. That's this lake right here. Van is the town, and there's a lake right there on the eastern edge of Turkey where this took place. This was April 20, 1915. 4 days later, the Ottoman government began deporting Armenians to Syria. This included the third and most brutal massacre of Armenians by the Ottomans. Many of the actual killers were Kurds. This is very, very painful. So I don't pretend to be an authority on it one way or another. These are essentially the facts that we're looking at. No one can put an exact number on this, and I refuse to do that. I don't know. I don't think anyone can put an actual number on the number of Armenians that were killed by the Ottomans. It certainly was in the many thousands, many hundreds of thousands, but I don't know. Likely no one will ever actually know what an exact count is. And I would say this also for those of you who are of the same heritage that I have. How many Native Americans did we slaughter when we came through this piece of land and took it as our own? I don't think anyone has any accurate number. Was that a genocide? It's a very poisonous word, as you know, and I'm not going to use it here in connection with the Turks and the Armenians. But this is my own culture. How many Native Americans did we kill? Does anyone have any idea? Anyhow, this is the mudslinging part. You know, we can throw mud in the eyes of the Turks and the Armenians. Well, let's keep the mud for ourselves. And try to take care of our own house. That's the way I would view that. Okay, then, right, let's go here. I'm going to, how are we doing for time? Are we okay?
You have plenty of time.
Okay, all right. 1923 was the beginning of the Turkish Republic, and here is where Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, many of you know who I'm referring to, was a central creator of this new Turkish nation that we call Turkey now today. I'm going to go to some other maps right now to show you how a little bit outside of the it'll be a little bit outside of the central part of our discussion, but I want you to see this. I'm going to give you this map in several different times because I want you to pay attention to what's actually happening. This is Armenia today. And as you can see, it's a very small country. If you see that there, that's 31 miles. It's just very small. This is a lake. This is Yerevan, which is the capital of Armenia. Finally, Armenians have their piece of land. It was a Soviet republic, as you know, for a long time. That does not mean sovereignty. But that is, in fact, the case now. It's small, but it is home. Then if you look at something on another map, Azerbaijan. I want to mention this briefly because these are Turks as well. It's important to remember that there are a lot of Turkic people. It's not just the people of Turkey. Azeri, Azerbaijani is a language. In fact, when I'm with Azeris, I speak Turkish, and they understand almost everything. Do you find that also? It's very close. It's really almost a dialect of Turkish. So I'm including it here only because of this issue of the Armenians and the Turks. Follow this with me for a bit, if you will. This is Turkey over here. Then there's Armenia is right in here. But here's a little chunk of Azerbaijan that's between Armenia and actually Iran. Then this is Azerbaijan, but this is a province within Azerbaijan that is Armenian. So if you just look at the physical map of where these people live, if you start here, you have Turk, Armenian, Turk, Armenian, Turk, Turk. That's the reality in a very short, a small piece of the world. That's the reality. And so it's high time that we get to that better place, because these folks live together. They really are there together. Heifer International, that I mentioned to you recently, has been active in both Armenia and Azerbaijan. There have been a number of examples of passing on the gift, which is when it's a calf, for example, a female calf, the first female calf is passed on to another family. There have been exchanges like this between Armenians and Azerbaijanis, both directions. You give a high-quality animal to a poor family so that they can survive. That's connecting on the human level, the level of humanity. That's where we'll find the heart and soul of everyone around the world. And then the animosity of the past can begin to melt away just a bit. I must mention something else that relates to the Greeks then in this regard, and that is that in 1999 there was a massive earthquake in Turkey. Thousands of people died. What is remarkable is how much the Greeks came to help the Turks in this time of devastation. It has happened in both directions. In fact, one of the Greeks who was responsible for this help in the earthquake said something like, it's easy for us to fight when everything is going well. When there's, you know, when there's relative peace, we can, all those rotten Turks, you know, all those Greeks, I've heard both sides. But when Mother Nature comes in and wipes people out, then everybody can cry, because now, and they did, the Greeks and the Turks cried together in helping each other to get through the earthquake of 1999. Very quickly, in recent times also now, things have happened just in the last 2 years that have been remarkable. Soccer diplomacy, September 2008. Turkey and Armenia, the Turkish President Gül goes to Yerevan for a soccer match. Okay, now that, I'll put the other map back here again so that you'll see what I'm referring to. That's not the one, sorry. Okay, where is this guy? Here it is, yeah. All right, so here you see, so the Turkish president, Ankara is the capital of Turkey. Yerevan is the capital of Armenia. That's where the match took place. Soccer. It's happened more than once since then. In August of last year, Vladimir Putin visits Turkey for a gas pipeline project and a nuclear power plant. October, just this past October, Secretary Hillary Clinton meets with the foreign ministers of Armenia and Turkey in Switzerland to normalize relationships, to open the border. That's just unbelievable when you think about the history. And then just now, just a few days ago, Putin met with Prime Minister Erdogan for the exchange of energy assets for assistance in relations with Armenia. Things are happening, and it's wonderful to see. I could go on and on, but you know, maybe this might be a good time to
another
just,
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay, all right. So let me go back to this again to just show you. This is another map that I want to show this relationship between the Turks and the Armenians today. So you bear with me just a bit, but look at this again. This is Turkey. This is Armenia. This is Iran. Azerbaijan tucks in right here. So you have Turk, Armenian, Turk, Armenian, Turk, Armenian, Turk. In just a matter of 10 miles or so apart from each other, 10 or 15. That's a little hard to... relate this to our own background. How do you keep the hatred going? At some point, you have to call a halt to it. It doesn't work. It doesn't continue. There's no basis for it. And I might say something else. Let's go back to the three principles that we started with. It doesn't mean you have to love these people. You know, that's probably, maybe that's a bit much. But look at something else that's really important here. How do we survive the next 500 years or 1,000 years? How do we thrive the next 500 years or 1,000 years? We do that by acting, by acknowledging, by giving recognition to the culture that supposedly has been in opposition to us. I have to mention one quick thing about the Arab world briefly, and it relates to this, and Islam in general. You and I would not even know about Aristotle, essentially, if it had not been for the Muslim translators, Arab Muslim translators. One of our mistakes in Western European culture, and we've carried it out here, we still do, is we dismiss people. We just dismiss them, right? We dismiss the Muslims, dismiss the Mexicans. Anyone speaking Spanish south of the border, we dismiss them. We've done that too much. I'm being harsh now on my own culture. That's the only one that I will do it with. But that hurts us. We're shooting ourselves in the foot if we continue to dismiss other cultures. So let's just go. I'll just go back now again to this this first page that I gave you. I think I'll just mention to you as well. In my own, I've been involved with Armenians and Turks and Arabs and Greeks now since I took my third year of college in Beirut, Lebanon. I was talking with Michael about this earlier today. I was really quite surprised when I went to the American University of Beirut in 1963. That's going to date me pretty well there. How many Armenians there were at the university, and how many languages they knew. My goodness, they knew automatically. They spoke Turkish and Armenian and French. Remember, this was a French area, and Arabic and Armenian. They've learned, they know. If you just go through high school, you already have four or five languages. Languages will change you. There's an expression, bilim var Türkçe. Bir lisan, bir insan. Siz biliyorsunuz, değil mi? Bir lisan, bir insan. İki lisan, iki insan. One language, one person. Two languages, two persons. The best way for us to get to this better place, on number three, two and three here, is to learn their language. And it's not so hard. And you know, those of us who those of us who have hair of this color, some of you in this room are like me in that regard, it's never too late. In fact, you can learn languages faster now. There's a stereotype that you can't learn language after the age of 30, right? It's finished. You're over the hill. Wrong, completely wrong. I learn languages faster now than ever. Why? It's because I'm motivated. I really see the value of that. If Turks will learn Armenian, if Armenians learn Turkish, if Greeks will learn some Turkish, in which they do, I've spoken already with Michael about this a little bit, and if you and I will learn some Chinese and some Armenian and some Turkish, a little bit goes a long way. Are we there? A little bit goes a long way. You don't have to be fluent in Turkish. I speak quite a bit of Turkish, but I'm not a native, so I make mistakes. But a little bit goes a long way. Why? What happens? These various pillars that we're talking about occur if you try. So what if your pronunciation is no good? Who cares? Just go ahead and say it. And in the process, I think you're going to find this more than 90% of the time, if you come out with an expression in Chinese or Armenian to a person of that heritage, what's going to happen on their face? Their face will light up. Say, oh, so that's an American who actually cares enough about the way I talk all day long to try to validate who I am, to validate my communication, to validate my culture. And I choose to be optimistic on that, and I think most of you probably are. You wouldn't have been here today. So maybe this is a good time to open it to questions.
Ευχαριστώ πάρα πολύ.
Our thanks to Dr. Stephen West for his comments here today. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council, and I will be moderating today's question and answer period. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Turkey and Armenia with Dr. Stephen West. Dr. West, we have some very interesting questions, and I will attempt to do justice to them. The first one says, the Ottomans gave one quarter of the city of Jerusalem to the Armenians in exchange for their tile work on the Dome of the Rock. So they were living together peaceably then. What happened? Why did the Armenians feel that they were not part of the Turkish-Armenian polity separate from religion?
Oh my, that's a great question. As you, those many of you have been to Jerusalem, you know there are four quarters, and one of them is the Armenian quarter. If you go back to that period of time, what you will find is that this nationalism that I referred to that's gone on for the last 150 or 200 years was really non-existent. The Ottomans didn't actually control what we would call Israel or Palestine or Jerusalem at this time. They didn't control them in the sense that a modern state would control them. There was a governor, and taxes were collected, and often maybe tribute, maybe soldiers were provided, but there was a distance. There was no Iraq in Ottoman times. There was a governor in Baghdad. And so to try to answer that question is to... The material only makes sense if you look at the bigger picture, which is that the Ottoman involvement was limited, and also remember what I mentioned before, that the Armenians were people of the book and still are. And the Ottomans did a fairly good job of recognizing and validating the people of the book, in this case the Christians. We could probably go on with that, but maybe that's... If the person asking that question would like to add to it, that's fine.
Another one. In your view, are the economic advantages being gained by Armenia worth the concessions they are making in regards to the
Karabakh, yes.
Karabakh, and the official Turkish recognition of the Armenian genocide of 1915?
Oh, my. I don't want to answer that. I don't feel qualified to answer that. If you look at the history of Armenia, it was of course much bigger than it is now. So if space is at such a high premium around the world, especially in the Middle East, I'm not trying to make an apology for the Turks here. I'm really not. So I really don't know if I could answer that in any way without adding to the mudslinging. I think the Turks can afford to be fairly generous at this point. Mm-hmm. That would apply to the people of Turkey as well as to Azerbaijan on this issue. Where do you draw the line? That is the crucial issue. You look at it, you see it between Israel and Palestine. Whose land is this? It's a very poisonous one. I think that's about the only way I want to answer it. I will tell you this. I'd rather stay away from politics and military discussions. And here's the reason why. It's too late. If you're talking about military movements or political movements, it's way after the fact. The work needs to have been done long before there's a political choice or a military choice. And that's a cultural one. That's a soft word that maybe it doesn't have quite the gravitas to it that, you know, a marching army may have, but it's far more important. It has to happen. If it's too late, and maybe in this case it's too late, well, start working on it now. Work on the cultural material. Work on the values of your country. And then the political and military answers will flow from that. Okay.
It's interesting because there are a lot of questions that have to do use the word massacre, and there is one in particular that uses the word genocide.
Right.
And the person asks the question, why didn't you use the word genocide?
Yeah, I don't feel qualified to. That's a very poisonous word. I can tell you that Turks that I from Turkey and very progressive ones will not allow that term to be used. I don't feel that I can answer that. I will say this. You look at what a genocide is. Genocide is a conscious attempt to remove everybody. And the Turks would say, the ones I'm referring to would say, we didn't try to remove all Armenians from the face of the earth. I know I'm going into a fiery area, and I insist on staying on the top here. So I'm sorry. I just pass on that. I don't feel qualified to do that. Maybe I'm a chicken. I don't know. But I don't want to use the word. Okay. It's too poisonous. Yes.
Another question. Is it possible for Turkey to develop democracy without acknowledging the painful parts of history?
Okay. I would say that Turkey can and needs to do that. It needs to acknowledge what it has done. Is it a democracy? Well, what's a democracy? Do we have a democracy in this country? We can go there, and I could go off on that for an hour. But here's the way I see Turkey from my experience. Turkey is kind of I would call it a forced democracy. And it works like this. This is not it's not a judgment. But Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, although he died in 1938, is still alive. He's still the president of your country. And you could, it was a lot more than George Washington. It's George Washington and Abe Lincoln and multiplied 100 times. And he insisted on a democracy. Now, how do you enforce that? It's through the military. It's through the army. It's through the generals. And if you look at the history of Turkey, since Atatürk died, about every 10 years, the military comes in. The notion is this. You can have a civilian democracy if you do it right, if you do it the way Atatürk taught us how to do it. But if you get it wrong, we'll sit you down and we'll force you to sign some documents, and we're going to throw you out, and we'll have a military regime for a few years. And then we'll try it again. You know, and maybe this time you'll get a brain and do it right. So it's kind of I see it as a forced democracy. That word is a poisonous word. It's from your heritage also, Michael. That's where we take it from. I personally love democracy, but I don't know about you, but I'm concerned about democracy in this country. Aren't you? Okay.
Its roots are power to the people.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
An academic question. It is my understanding that the Ottoman archives have never been fully open to scholarly review with regards to the Armenian question. If so, how can an accurate and honest discussion take place with a historical commission as proposed in the protocols?
Okay. I used to teach Ottoman. I taught the first level of Ottoman at Penn and at UCLA. Actually, one year, my entire Turkish class was made up of Armenian historians. They were Armenians who were going after this ability, both with modern Turkish and with Ottoman, to go after the archives. To say that they're closed, I don't know enough about it to answer, to say that it's a completely closed or completely open. I have used some Ottoman sources myself in Istanbul. They have not been close to me, but they haven't been historical background issue. They're more about literature, which is my field. I think I don't know enough to say, but I would shy away from the notion that they are completely closed. Let me put it another way: the Turks are not stupid. They know that they are part of a new movement in the world, as the globalization. They're part of the future, whatever that might be. The Turks have always been this way. That may be a little bit hard to recognize. But the Turks were that way with Islam. They embraced Islam 1,000 years ago with enthusiasm as they came from Central Asia into the Middle East. They learned new things. Look at the Koreans. Look at the Japanese today. You're seeing the same thing. Who makes the car that we drove here today is a Japanese. That's an Altaic receptivity. You find this in all the people. The Turks, the Mongols, the Koreans, the Japanese from ancient times have shown a receptivity toward new ideas and modernization. The Turks are doing it again now. Is it a perfect story? Probably not. But I would say this. I'll add this other thought to it. I think that if we could take these three desert religions, three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and lighten up a little bit on all three, that's one of the main ways we can make it through. Judaism light, Islam light, Christianity light. Lighten it up already. We could do that, and then allow each other to have our spirituality, but move on with it. We can do that. So maybe that's going off a little bit far on that particular question. Another one.
Okay. And they keep coming. There are greater geopolitical reasons for the West intervening with ongoing problems between Turkey and Armenia. Can you speak more to that?
The first part is that there are more.
There are greater geopolitical reasons for the West intervening with the ongoing problems between Turkey and Armenia. Can you speak more to that?
Okay. When you say the West, are you including Russia in this? I'm assuming that you are. I'm not sure. I'll assume that that's the case. If we call that the West, the Russians, of course, speak a language that is directly related to English. There's a Christian heritage and so on. Putin has been very active just in the last few days. Hillary Clinton has been very active. Yes, there is. Let's look at another big picture issue here. When I was a kid in the 50s, civil defense was part of my life in the public schools. Maybe some of you can remember that. Russia, the whole idea of Russia, of communism, was so high on the fear indicator for our country that it's hard to believe that we're now talking with the Russians. Well, the Russians and the Americans do indeed have the capability of huge geopolitical solutions or problems, and the Chinese as well. So what's remarkable is that there's more peace on this earth since about 1989 than there has ever been before in the history of humankind. I know I'm making a sort of general statement there. But Putin and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and the presidents and the foreign ministers of Turkey and Armenia are talking. There is a certain amount of communication on the same page. It's not exactly the same page, but it's new. And it is, I'm convinced that the geopolitical part to this is massive. Okay.
A geographic question. You mentioned Greater and Lesser Armenia. Were they small areas, or did they abut each other?
Oh, yes. Actually, that's. I'll go back just briefly on that one with this one map here. It was actually, some of you may be from that, know the area quite well. Where's the one of Turkey here? Right, here we go. If you see here, the Tigris and Euphrates River have a lot to do with this. I'll back out of the way here. Some of you will have to just catch it as we go by. But the Euphrates River, both of them start in Turkey. And here's the Tigris over here. Essentially, under the Romans, that's the first time when this was determined. It was west of the river and east of the river for Armenia. That was just a broad division. So it's essentially, I'll go over here for a minute, the area of Adana. These are called the Cilician Gates. It's a series of passes through the mountains that many conquerors have made use of. Alexander did it, and Arab armies did it. The Romans did it. It's a way of getting through. And Armenia, Lesser Armenia, was essentially here. And you can see the river is here. Greater Armenia has always been between Van, Lake Van, and the Caucasus Mountains that run here. That goes back 3,000 years. So at three times at least, this was a reality, a part of Lesser Armenia, but this was always considered the greater section, the greater Armenia.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where there's time for just one last question. There were many other questions here, and I would encourage those who did ask those questions to meet with Dr. West afterwards, and he will be able to answer them. Many had to do with this very passionate an emotional issue of genocide. I think that there is a positive question here. How does one overcome this reality or what you've been speaking about?
Yeah, I don't know that that one can overcome it entirely, and I think it would be a mistake to completely overcome it. The notion, for example, of the Holocaust, some people will say that's revision of history, didn't happen. Yes, it did. And I visited the Mauthausen killer camp when I was 16 years old. It's left a very powerful impression upon me. The brutality that all of us have experienced, either victims of that or perpetrators of that, we dare not forget that. That's a mistake for us to wipe out everything that happened before the year 2000 and say it didn't take place. There is a certain amount of energy in academic circles to say anything written before the year 2000 is irrelevant. I feel very strongly against that. Overcome it needs to be recognized. I don't think we can overcome it. I don't think we can move beyond it unless we recognize it and take responsibility for it. Who are the killers? Who did that? You take responsibility for that. And then, and it's a matter of reconciliation. It's a matter of being honest about what actually took place in history. I think it's the only way we can overcome it.
Our thanks to Dr. Stephen West for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those who are listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is hereby adjourned.